Celebrating Cassini one last time, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. Nothing could top the Cassini mission's grand finale, so we'll merely celebrate it this week by bringing you highlights of our September 18th live tribute to the mission, featuring three of its leaders, along with our own Emily Lakdawalla. The Planetary Society and I are so grateful to our partners at KPCC, Southern California Public Radio. It was SCPR's wonderful in-person crew that got us Caltech's huge Beckman Auditorium and took care of all the logistics. I was joined on stage by KPCC science reporter Jacob Margolis. You can enjoy nearly all of the more than 90-minute show in the podcast version of this week's Planetary Radio. It's at planetary.org/radio.
Please welcome to the stage Cassini project scientists Linda Spilker, Cassini program manager Earl Mays, and Cassini spacecraft operations manager Julie Webster. There is one more person joining us, my Planetary Society colleague, senior editor Emily Lakdawalla. She's here in part to represent the scores of citizen scientists who have contributed to this mission. Emily Lakdawalla. So, welcome everyone, and congratulations. I was here Friday morning before 5 a.m., about 4 a.m., for that glorious bittersweet finish, then ran over to JPL to be with, well, Emily and Jacob were there for the press conference. It was one of the greatest mornings of, I have to say, of my life. We have so much to talk about in limited time, but let's begin with this. For the benefit of the one or two people in this very sophisticated audience who don't remember or know why did we crash Cassini? Earl.
Well, it's been the plan for 7 years, and really the reason was to use every possible piece of that spacecraft in the most optimal scientific way possible. We couldn't leave Cassini floating around derelict around Saturn. It is, you know, because of the potential prebiotic nature of both Titan and Enceladus, particularly Enceladus, we couldn't contaminate it. So we had to put the spacecraft away. The idea was to use all the fuel and go out in a blaze of glory getting Saturn science for the very last second.
That's exactly what happened, right?
That's correct.
You were getting data.
Absolutely.
Right to the very end.
Right to the very end.
All of you, all three of you, have been with this mission for so many years. Linda, for you, what, almost 30 years?
Almost 30 years, almost a whole Saturn year.
You got to ask, how does it feel to be really at the end of an era? Julie?
You know, it's amazing, but it's exactly what Earl said. You know, we did it. We designed it. We knew that this day would come 9 years ago. It's everything that we expected it to be, and it was time. We were starting to worry about things going wrong. Mm.
You were all together, most of you were together, for such a long time. Did it start to feel like a family?
Oh, absolutely. I think we got to know each other really well. In some cases, our kids grew up together. We'd take vacations together, go out to dinner, and really got to know each other as people and not just professionals.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Yeah. We would finish each other's sentences, take care of dog sit for each other. It was very, very much a family. And the entire, and the entire set of skills and personalities that you expect in a large extended family. Not like we always got along all the time, but that's what families do.
There were a couple of references at the press conference to that old scientists versus engineers discussion, yeah. Right, Julie?
That's why Earl's in the middle.
That's why I'm in the middle.
that's why you said, it's like my mother separated my sisters in church even when we were adults.
That's right.
Well, we did. But Linda's going to give you my final line to all the scientists was we were there for the science.
Absolutely. And when Julie said that, it just melted my heart. It was great.
Yeah. And you know, she got 23 times past Enceladus. So we worked our way in. We started way far on thrusters and worked our way in slowly but surely, and just knew that there wasn't anything. So we didn't take any chances with Cassini, but we did. We did.
You pushed the envelope once or twice.
Right. Oh, absolutely, half a dozen, absolutely. Or a dozen times. Yeah,
that tension between engineering and science is what really makes you get the absolute most out of the mission. When everyone's asking for a little bit more than they probably can get, and saying, someone's saying, well, you can't quite get as much as you're asking for, but I'll give you a little bit more than I said. that balance is what I think Cassini will take as a takeaway, as one of the big successes, is to find the right sweet spot between science and engineering.
Absolutely.
Absolutely true.
We know the data came right to the end. Images did not. We have, I think, the very last image captured by the spacecraft, and you got it in front of you on that monitor at the lip of the stage there. Linda, do you recognize it? What are we looking at?
We're looking at Saturn, and basically that dark shadowed line is probably just above the equator, and it's actually illuminated in ring shine. And in that picture is the place that Cassini finally plunged. And so it was very bittersweet to capture that image and know that somewhere in there, there's a little piece of Cassini.
Is this also a scientifically significant image?
Yes, you can look and study the clouds right till the very end. We've been looking at seasonal change on Saturn for almost two Saturn seasons, so scientifically interesting as well.
How about the three of you personally? Where do you go from here? Let's start with the engineers. Are you done, Julie?
Well, Earl says I'm not. Earl thinks I owe him an engineering report. He knows what kind of writer I am. I've got 20 years of engineering to break down and write about. We don't write papers as well as the scientists do, so we've got a lot of catching up to do.
Oh, you can't see. They're laughing because Emily's shaking her head.
Yeah, it's really true.
Yeah. You know, but the tension is gone.
Absolutely. The tension.
We like that.
I don't want to
tension.
Say the thrill is gone.
No, we like that tension.
We like the tension. I think a month after not being called in the middle of the night, I'll be out looking for another job.
Yeah, well, I've got to get that report for her really fast. But I think, you know, I think both of us have been pretty myopic about what's next, just trying to get this done properly. And now we make some jokes about paperwork and things like that, but I think by, you know, after the holidays, we get ourselves documented up, I think we'll be looking around and we'll see what we find.
Linda, speaking for you, yourself and the other scientists on the mission, you're far from done.
Right. We have another year's worth of funding, but far longer to actually look at and try and understand all of the Cassini data, in particular the 22 orbits from the grand finale. And I have some data in there, too. I work with the composite infrared spectrometer. There are some beautiful ring scans, and I'm looking forward to diving into the data, looking at these things called C-ring plateaus, these thicker regions in the C-ring and greater, higher resolution than ever before. And I'm also on a proposal, one of these proposals for New Frontiers. It's called Enceladus Life Finder, or ELF, to go back to Enceladus. And so, who knows, maybe in December I'll be one of those three working on another proposal. If not, I'll root for whatever mission NASA picks.
Are the citizen scientists going to keep digging through everything
Absolutely.
That's come back?
And you know, the Cassini mission was very generous to share those raw images on the internet, but they were actually kind of a cruddy version of the data set. They were not calibrated. Right. They were squashed down with JPEG compression. It was kind of gnarly. And so now my hope is that I can encourage more of the amateurs to go into the NASA archives, use the real science quality data, because there's so much more subtle detail available in those images than anybody's been able to appreciate from the raw JPEGs. And so my goal, I think, is to encourage more people to participate in that kind of image processing.
Linda, do you have an idea offhand of how many papers have been based on Cassini data, and how many PhDs have been achieved?
Well, we have over 3,000 science papers so far. Wow. And I'm sure in the next year and in the decades to come, there'll be far more papers and books. We've literally rewritten the books about Saturn and Titan and the rings. and probably dozens of PhD theses, I don't know the exact number, and those will continue as well with this very, very rich data set.
So just as you were a fairly young scientist, a PhD when this got started, it's a good way to bring the youngins up.
Oh, absolutely. I've had some wonderful postdocs that have worked with me over the years. In fact, my very first postdoc is now the project scientist for the Huygens component of the Cassini mission. I tell him, I'm so proud of you. This is great.
The second half of our live celebration of the Cassini mission is still ahead. And so is your chance to win great space art in this week's What's Up Space Trivia Quiz. This is Planetary Radio.
Hey, Planetary Radio listeners, the Planetary Society now has an official online store. We've teamed up with Chop Shop, known for their space mission posters, to bring you space-inspired art and merchandise. You can find exclusive Planetary Society t-shirts, posters, and more. Visit planetly/spaceshop to learn more. That's planet.ly/spaceshop.
Our LightSail 2 solar sail mission is almost ready to fly, but we need your help in these last months before launch. I'm LightSail Program Manager Bruce Betts with an invitation to become part of our revolutionary CubeSat project. Your donation will help secure a $50,000 matching gift from a generous member of the Planetary Society. You can learn more at planetary.org/lightsail. That's planetary.org/lightsail. With your help, we'll soon be sailing on the light of the sun.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan with more of our live tribute to the Cassini mission and team. Let's go back to the standing room only Beckman Auditorium at Caltech. It was the evening of September 18th, barely 3 days after the spacecraft had plunged into Saturn's atmosphere, delivering great science up to the second it began to tumble, and only a minute or so before it broke apart and was vaporized. Emily Lakdawalla, Jacob Margolis, Earl Mays, Linda Spilker, and Julie Webster were talking with me about the European Space Agency's Huygens probe that descended from Cassini to the surface of Saturn's strangely Earth-like moon, Titan.
How did having both of these result in better science?
Well, Huygens provided ground truth. We knew what the landscape was, the composition of the gases coming out of the surface. So we had one point on the surface we knew very well. And then with the rest of the mission, we could use the radar, look in the near infrared, and map the rest of Titan and put it in context with this one point from Huygens. So that was very valuable. And also as we went down through the atmosphere, ground truth also for the composition of the atmosphere, the pressure, and all of the things that Huygens could do uniquely on the surface.
Yeah, the atmospheric density, which the engineers and the scientists came up with different densities at Titan because we used the thrusters and the scientists were using INMS, the mass spectrometer, that got the last data at Saturn. And we had a huge factor difference, and you know, Huygens provided the ground truth on that one too.
Hmm. I don't think there are any astrobiologists up here on the stage. Maybe we have some in the audience, but I know astrobiologists who are actively considering how life could exist in this frigid place, beyond frigid. Obviously, it wouldn't be life as we know it. Do you find this line of research interesting? Linda, I guess you go to you again.
I find it very intriguing. Could you have life that could use liquid methane in place of liquid water and have the chemistry that you need? It's cold there, it's not as efficient to use methane compared to water, but there is a possibility. And there have been calculations by astrobiologists, and it would be very intriguing, very interesting to send a boat into one of these Titan seas and make some measurements to see just what you find there.
The seas are very deep on Titan?
The seas are
shallow. How deep are the seas on
Titan?
Well,
we've done bathymetry, and we know that some are about, there's over 100 meters on one of them that actually, so they're not just shallow ponds. They really are, I think we've likened them to the volume of the Great Lakes.
Right, it's about the same depth of the Great Lakes, about the same size as the Great Lakes. Huge, tremendous volume of methane. And this was something we didn't know we could do. We bounced the radar off the top surface of the lake, got a really strong booming signal, And actually this young person who had worked on some other data looked at it and said, look, there's a second signal. I think it's bouncing off the bottom. And sure enough, we could then map the bottom of the lake and see how deep it was and how much methane was inside.
You already mentioned the speculation or the proposals that have seriously proposed a boat to go sailing on the seas of Titan. I got a great t-shirt that says Surf Titan. But there are other proposals as well. Earl, what would you like to see go back to Titan?
Well, I think the boat is clearly one, but I think the edges of those lakes is where I would want to see something going on, something that could... I have no background in astrobiology, so I'm free to speculate wildly without any repudiation of my professional career. But I think that what's going to happen is going to be at the edges of those on the shores. We've watched this odd sort of, as the lakes come and recede, some coloration changes and structure changes. So I'd like to actually see something that could spend time at that fringe. And put in a plug for my robot buddies at JPL, we've got the technology. It just needs to be operating in very cold. But that's where I'd like to go. So.
Titan is an aeronaut's dream because it has a relatively thick atmosphere. It's about the same density as Earth, a little bit denser, but the gravity is much lower and the atmosphere is much taller. So you could take, say, a balloon or some other kind of fairly simple gliding aircraft. And you know, if you were a human there in a appropriate spacesuit, you could take like little wing-like device and just flap around in the atmosphere. It would be wonderful. So some kind of flying thing that could go up, catch a trade wind, go down, sample the surface, rise up again, and just kind of dot all over Titan and take pictures would be lovely.
Juliet, I was just talking to somebody who was talking about a quadcopter, like a drone that so many people now own.
Really?
That's true. That's a mission proposal in New Frontiers to fly a quadcopter on Titan.
A quadcopter on Titan. Okay.
I'll volunteer to be the one on the surface with the remote.
We'll go. We'll go. You know, just tell me how to get there. Yeah.
We've gone below the surface of those seas, but even deeper down, we've learned that Titan is a world of multiple oceans, because if you go deep enough, right, there's a water ocean. Linda?
Exactly. A liquid water ocean underneath Titan's icy crust. We wonder if there might be a connection somehow to the surface. We know that methane needs to be replenished because it's broken apart in the top of the atmosphere, and over time it would disappear. If all the methane is gone, Titan's atmosphere would collapse. So something, some process has to keep releasing methane. Maybe it's with water, with some ammonia like an antifreeze, and it can carry methane up. We're not sure of the process, but we know it has to get replenished.
We have sadly reached the end of the evening. I want to thank all of our guests for being here, and please help us thank Planetary Society Senior Editor Emily Lakdawalla, Cassini Mission Manager Linda Spilker, Cassini Mission Program Manager Earl Mays, and Cassini Mission Spacecraft Operations Manager Julie Webster. And that is along with the 5,000 scientists, engineers, and others who have made the Cassini mission one of the greatest voyages of exploration ever.
Excerpts from our live December 18th celebration of the Cassini mission at the California Institute of Technology's Beckman Auditorium. There's much more of that wonderful evening at planetary.org/radio, and you can see the entire show that we titled Destined to Crash, Cassini's Grand Finale, including all of the great images. That link is also on this week's show page at planetary.org/radio. We finish up with What's Up. And that means that Dr. Bruce Betts, the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society, has joined us once again. Welcome back. What's up in the night sky?
The exciting thing going on is Venus and Mars in the pre-dawn. That's the pre-dawn east. Venus is the super bright object, and Mars is coming up from below it, getting closer and closer each day until they are really, really close on October 5th, and then they'll begin to separate again. We've also got Jupiter and Saturn in the evening sky. We move on to This Week in Space History. It was 10 years ago this week that the Dawn spacecraft launched and then went off to explore Vesta and now Ceres.
We'll be talking to Mark Raymond. I think in 2 weeks we're going to have a conversation with the chief engineer and mission director for Dawn. It's already in the can. A little update
Great.
On that mission.
All right, we move on, and we've got a special help, don't we?
We sure do. You know, we love it when we get a little help from listeners.
We do indeed.
Yeah, to introduce a random space fact. This came from Jeremy Kokal. I hope I have his name pronounced. I hope I pronounced it correctly. I will mention up front that he's a big fan of yours. He took your course.
Oh, cool.
Actually earned a certificate in doing Bruce's periodic intro to astronomy course offered by Cal State Dominguez Hills. People can still see that, right?
They can. You can find it at planetary.org/BETS class, BETTS class.
In addition to being now a certificated astronomer.
Well, I'm not. Yeah, sure.
Jeremy.
Congratulations, nonetheless.
Okay. Jeremy is also the tenor in a group called the Moon Rays, which he describes as Southern California's premier doo-wop group. And these guys do a lot of top stuff, man. You know the Dapper Dans, the barbershop quartet at Disneyland? I used to love to listen to them when I worked there. They have Broadway careers, some of them. They do all kinds of stuff. They've even been on stage at Coachella. So here are the Moon Rays with their random space fact intro.
We got a random space fact, random space fact, random space fact, random space fact.
That was very cool.
Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you, guys. That was
that
was lovely.
All right, I'm not done with Cassini. The Cassini spacecraft, over its 20-year mission, traveled the equivalent of nearly 200,000 times around the Earth.
Holy cow, that is impressive. You've honored the Moon Rays with a wonderful random space fact.
Sorry, I guess I should have done something moon-related. I didn't connect it all together. Speaking of Cassini, we asked, on what rocket did the Cassini spacecraft launch in 1997? How'd we do?
Got a huge response for this. People love Cassini, I suppose. Random.org picked longtime listener, first-time winner, if he's got this right, Kevin Nitka of Forked River, New Jersey. He says, Cassini launched on a Titan 4B Centaur on October 15th, 1997.
That is correct.
Kevin, congratulations. He went on to say, a truly wonderful experience from launch to end, and all the Cassini gave thanks to all who made her and kept her for all mankind. Kevin has won himself a new Chop Shop Design Planetary Radio t-shirt. You can see those at chopshopstore.com. There's a whole Planetary Society store there, sub-store, and a 200-point iTelescope.net astronomy account from iTelescope, the nonprofit worldwide network of telescopes that anybody can use. 200 points is worth a couple hundred dollars U.S. We're ready to move on.
I don't often ask for definitions, but I think this one is... This word is often misconstrued, so let's learn a little something. What is the definition of the metallicity of a star? Go to planetary.org/radiocontest.
Are you doing the devil's horns while you when you say metal?
Maybe.
You've got until Wednesday, October 4th at 8 a.m. to get us the answer to this one. We're going to give away again from Chop Shop, not the Planetary Radio t-shirt, but the just as, if not more, cooler Planetary Society shirt, the one we talked about last week, the Venn diagram of Mars and Earth that says Planetary Society at the intersection, a 200-point iTelescope.net account. And then, these artists have waited so long for this. Finally, we're going to start for the next several weeks giving away beautiful original art. Well, they're prints, actually, provided by members of the International Association of Astronomical Artists. We've had them on the show a few times, representatives from there. You can read about the association at IAAA.org, IAAA.org. This one from Simon Krieger. Simon, who's a good friend of the show, he has provided a couple of prints. We're going to give away an absolutely gorgeous print from Simon of the lunar module, Apollo lunar module, in its last few moments before setting down on the surface of the moon. It is gorgeous, and it could be yours if you're chosen by random.org and have the answer correct.
Well, that's very, very cool.
Yeah, it really is pretty.
All right, everybody. Go out there, look up in the night sky, and think about dog licks all over your face. Thank you, and good night.
That's Bruce, dog lover extraordinaire and director of science and technology for the Planetary Society, who joins us every week here for What's Up. By the way, you can see lots of Simon Krieger's work at simonkrieger.com. That's S-I-M-O-N-K-R-E-G-A-R, all one word. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its awesome members.
Before you go, we have a special treat from a local band, the Amoeba People. They make great music and they love science, so it shouldn't be surprising that they have created their own tribute to the grand finale. I think some of the band members are here tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, Saturnians and Titans, here is the Amoeba People's Cassini Dive Go. Good night, everyone. Clear skies.
Thank you.
Gotta take it back to 1997 when Cassini left the Earth for good. With the one-way ticket for a seven-year journey bound for Saturn and its neighborhood. Destination, the jewel of the planets had to leave the Earth far behind. But little did they know the success of the mission would leave it in such a bind. Oh, Cassini Dive Go! Oh, Cassini Dive Go! Gathering data and sending it back, information like we'd never seen. But when Cassini found water on unsettled disk, man, our faces turned a little green. It was scheduled to orbit ad infinitum, but now the risk was much too high. So one last dive through Saturn's rings, then it's time to light up the sky. Oh, Cassini dive go! Oh, Cassini dive go! Oh, mission's all done and the data's collected, Enceladus will need to be protected. When the mission's all done and the data's collected, Enceladus will need to be protected to avoid contamination and the risk of pollution. A grand finale is the only solution to avoid contamination and the risk of pollution. A grand finale is the only solution. Only solution. Yes. Only solution. Yes. If that's so, let's put on a good show.